I'm Frank Vaughn. It's May 28th, 2025, and in my continuing quest to help people understand the levels of decay that this country is in right now, we have to focus on justice to begin today's broadcast. And this isn't a good story. This is much disappointing. This article is, the title is, Husband of Assiniboia Day Home Operator Gets Record Sentence for Child Sex Crimes. Now, I need people to understand the backdrop. We've talked about C-75 and how it was passed into law and how it created the catch-and-release bail conditions that we have now, which have flooded our streets with criminals, taken away mandatory minimum sentencing, made it easier for child traffickers, reduced gang crime sentences. C-75 gutted the justice system. So even if the police do their jobs, the justices are turning criminals loose back on the streets. It's a terrible situation, and it's flooded our nation with crime. If you look at crime rates in Canada, they've only gone up under the Liberal government, and lo and behold, they've been reelected again. So get used to more of it. Wednesday afternoon brought an end to a child sex abuse court case, 20 years, 33 victims, and 73 charges in the making. Crown prosecutor said victims were relieved that at long last it seems as if some closure is coming. I don't know about that, and you're going to find out why. The sentence was handed down in Moose Jaw Provincial Court for Richard Dyke, who between 2005 and 2023 victimized at least 33 children, the youngest just 18 months old. He was given 17 years in prison, the longest sentence for child sexual offenses ever in Saskatchewan, according to Yusuf. Why is 17 years the longest sentence that's ever been handed down? The previous record was 15 years. Isn't this worse than murder? I mean, these kids are going to bear the burden of this victimization for the rest of their lives. They're going to have psychological problems. 18 months old. What kind of a sick individual looks at an 18-month-old child and sees an object of desire? Every single night I put my kids to bed and I look at them and I love them deeply. I can't even imagine the depth of evil that's required to convert that feeling of pure love into an object of desire. It is sickening. It's worse than murder, but it gets worse. Maybe there is a case lurking somewhere that we don't know about, an unreported case, but my colleagues agree with me that this is the longest sentence ever imposed in Saskatchewan. Now, here's the sad truth. He won't serve 17 years. We'll get into that because he's already been in jail since 2023 when he was arrested, and he gets credit for that. So the sentence is already reduced by a little over 2 years. Now, we're going to skip all this. We're going to go right to the end before we get into how long he might actually serve because the article doesn't tell you. It doesn't do the math. Orders in addition to the 17-year sentence include a firearms prohibition, a lifetime order for the sex offender registry, and an order not to contact any of the victims. The sex offender registry is useless because it's not public, unlike in other nations. The privacy of sex offenders is protected as soon as they leave jail. So the police will know where they are, but they have perfect freedom of action in public to reoffend, which they often do in Canada. You, as a person just living your life and being a citizen of this nation, have no right to know other than at the moment of release, as I've highlighted on this channel, because I can do this every single day. Not with sex offenders, but with criminals of every kind. I can pick another one that's been pushed out onto the streets. And you're informed that they're on the streets. You might be given a neighborhood that they'll be living in, and then that's it. Your right as a citizen to know where the danger is denied you as we protect criminals. That's what we do in Canada. But, as I said, it gets worse. This 17-year sentence, can you guess when this individual is going to be eligible for parole? October of 2028. Now, for those of you who can't do math, it is 2025. That's roughly 3 years. Now, he may not get parole. He has to go before a parole board, and they have to make a decision. But given the backdrop of how most of these people gain early parole if something's not done with them in jail by the people in jail interested in justice, meaning the other fellow inmates who often deal with these sick people in their own way. If he's actually still there and breathing in 2028, he'll go before a parole board and they may decide to release him 3 years before he's eligible for release. That's Canadian justice. In a not entirely unrelated matter, the king was here at great expense, not to himself, but to the Canadian taxpayer. And as you can see in the picture, our new prime minister sat like a good little supplicant next to the king of this country, who is the real head of state, through the governor general's office, which Carney rules. And we'll get into that a little bit more next, but nowhere in the Canadian press are we reminded of Charles's close association, not just to Jimmy Savile, but also Peter Ball. Now, Jimmy Savile first. Charles met Savile through shared interests in disability charities, particularly Savile's work with Stoke Mandeville Hospital. Savile was his informal advisor from 1986 to 2006. Now remember, Jimmy Savile, for all the heinous crimes that he was exposed for doing, it was all done after he died. So he effectively lived his life as a grotesque pervert, serial abuser of children, manipulating his public status to put himself in positions where he was close to the vulnerable so that he could exploit them. And a lot of people knew what was going on and did nothing. He lived his whole life, he got away with it and died. And that's a shame that we can't get him posthumously. Charles wrote letters to Savile seeking guidance on speeches, royal family conduct, and public engagement. Savile had frequent access to St. James Place and visited Charles' home in Glencoe in 1999 for a private meal. Savile drafted a media relations handbook for the royals, parts of which Charles shared with Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. Very high positions, family involvement. Charles asked Savile to advise Sarah Ferguson and act as an informal counselor during his marriage issues with Diana. Now, Charles says he wasn't aware of Savile's crimes. But another individual, Peter Ball, was a serial abuser. Charles' relationship with Peter Ball maintained a long-term friendship with Peter Ball, former Anglican bishop to Lewes and Gloucester. Ball described himself as a counselor to royalty and boasted of his connections with Charles. Charles corresponded with Ball for over two decades, starting before Ball's 1992 caution for gross indecency. Charles arranged for the Duchy of Cornwall to purchase a property for Ball and his brother, Michael, to rent after Ball's resignation. Charles wrote letters to Ball, including one in February 1995, expressing sympathy, stating, "I feel so desperately strongly about the monstrous wrongs that have been done to you." He was cautioned in 1993 for gross indecency with a 17-year-old boy. In 2015, Ball was convicted of sexually abusing 18 young men over three decades. Abuses included naked prayer rituals, beatings, mutual masturbation, often under the guise of spiritual guidance. Disgusting stuff. And Charles sympathized with him and thought that gross wrongs were done against Peter Ball's character. And that's not to mention the royal family's links to Jeffrey Epstein, which have been commentated on by a lot of people. Now, of course, the Canadian media has a distinct lack of curiosity and doesn't really want to tell the story about our king. And this is just the tip of the iceberg of questionable associations. We just fawningly support him because King Charles III defends Canada's sovereignty in speech to open parliament. Is Canada really sovereign? We've looked on this channel at Chinese Communist Party infiltration of this country. We've talked about how our assets and natural resources, our national wealth even, has been sold off to the highest bidder, foreign countries. How we have CCP police stations operating on Canadian soil. We train their troops. We have a huge money laundering problem for foreign terrorists. That Canada has become an international clearinghouse for crime. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Are we really sovereign? More importantly, are the people of Canada really sovereign? When all you get to do is mark an X every now and again for parliamentarians, which are not your government. The king is your government. The governor general is your government. The cabinet, which is appointed by parliament, is your government. They're going to rule throughout the summer. I'm going to show you some articles so you understand that while parliament is back in recess, it's only in session for 3 weeks. While parliament is back in recess, the government is going to continue to rule because parliament is not government. Cabinet and the governor general are government. Are we really sovereign? When we bow down before every United Nations edict and every desire of the World Economic Forum, when we now have a prime minister that is very interested in European integration, not in Canadian sovereignty, not in North American sovereignty, but in European integration and torpedoing the relationship with the United States, are we really sovereign? When we have mass immigration, when we have medical assistance in dying, as we call it, targeting our seniors and our mentally ill while we import, we now have 1.6 million immigrants in this country that are permanently disabled. Are we really sovereign when we're becoming overrun? Are we really sovereign when Canadian citizens of every ethnic background, race, color, and creed can't get jobs with some of the biggest operating corporations in this country, which are foreign-owned largely because they only hire temporary foreign workers, that is, foreigners who don't have citizenship because you as a taxpayer subsidize that hiring. So not only can you not get a job so that you can pay taxes, if you manage to find a job with someone else, the taxes that you pay are going to subsidize corporations to hire cheap foreign labor. Are we really sovereign? King Charles is defending that process. Now, just for the record, I'm a very happy man. I have a happy life. I got beautiful kids. I got a wife. I've never considered self-harm. I'm not suicidal. I've never been criminally charged, let alone convicted. I am fully bondable. And I like being on this side of the sod, and I intend to stay this way. The headline is, Carney is already steamrolling basic constraints on power. This is to deal with special warrants, which are signed by the governor general, issuing record spending never been done before in Canadian history on this level, especially after a contentious election that resulted in a hung parliament. In spite of Carney talking about a mandate, he does not have a majority. In fact, the quest for a majority via judicial review fell by the wayside, and they are well short of their goal. With both actions, the new Liberal government has neutered one of the reasons Canada has a parliament in the first place. Remember, parliament's not government. Parliament makes laws. Parliament doesn't interpret laws. Parliament appoints government. Parliament is not government. Has neutered one of Canada has parliament, one of the reasons Canada has parliament in the first place, to review and manage the disbursement of money. The direct control of national finance has been referred to as the great task of a modern parliamentary government, reads the procedural guidebook given to all new Canadian MPs. The text then reminds them that the House of Commons has exclusive control over the business of public finance. It shouldn't be surprising that the very guidebooks we give parliamentarians are full of falsehoods, because that is a falsehood. And Mark Carney's putting paid to that falsehood right now. I want to just scroll down to the most... So they're talking about, in the article, they're talking about the other times special warrants have been issued or times that the there hasn't been a federal budget. So the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, there wasn't a budget. In the midst of the Second World War, when the feds went a record 482 days between budget presentations. But what hasn't really happened before is a government refusing to table a budget in the immediate aftermath of a contentious federal election resulting in a hung parliament. Upon news of Carney's no-budget plans, Conservative MP Mike Lake noted that the Tories had a budget ready only 5 weeks after their victory in the 2011 general election. Election day was May 2nd, and the Finance Minister Jim Flaherty had a budget in front of the Commons on June 6th. And remember, during the election campaign, Carney said, "I'm an economist. I can handle it." With it reminds me of, because it's 2015. It's one of those sweeping sentences that the fawning Canadian media, which is paid for by the state, ran with, the liberal base ran with, but it was absolutely vacuous and empty of substance. And I wonder if there's enough people in Canada anymore who actually care about how this country is run. Now, I just want to note something. On screen, hopefully, yes, on screen is the summary of the last special warrant that was signed, which issued another $30-odd billion in spending. Now, we've gone through some of the line items, like noting how the Department of Employment and Social Development got $5 billion and how Indigenous Affairs got $2 billion, and what that might actually indicate about the state of the economy. But I don't want to focus on that today. I just want to focus on this. This special warrant only covers about 45 days from May 16th to June 29th. That means Parliament's going to sit for its 3 weeks, and then they're going to recess for the summer. And in the wake of that recess, since there's not going to be a budget, there will be another special warrant signed while they're away on vacation. So once again, the government will spend tens of billions of dollars of your money without parliamentary oversight on the signature of the Governor General. And people say the king is symbolic and the Governor General's office is symbolic. In the pen of the Governor General lies the power of spending, not in Parliament. Not even in cabinet. The Prime Minister can just go over to Rideau Hall and get a document signed and spend all your money and increase the national debt. That's your country. That's the system. That's what's actually happening. And anybody that would try and gaslight you into saying that it's not the way this is, that we are a modern, thriving democracy, they literally are the people who do not know how our system functions and operates. And this is why I say, we are a backwards nation. People everywhere, including your premiers, should be demanding better. We should be reforming the system at the very least, or disposing of it, or advocating for disposing of it to create more power to the people, more say for the provinces, more autonomy, better representation, better rights, the ability to advance referendum questions during elections, the right of recall, an elected Senate, oversight of the judiciary by Parliament. Oversight of the government by citizens. But all of these concepts are deemed radical by those who benefit from the bureaucratic banana monarchy which we live in. And so we have to start with stupid takes because there's plenty of them online. Richard Buck, Trumpy just can't accept no for an answer. Mexico didn't pay for any of the wall. See, he's too simple to understand how tariffs work. And when Trump said Mexico will pay for the wall, he was talking about value extraction via tariffs. And Canada will pay its fair share for NORAD, as we always have. He makes up numbers and attacks Canada on days that are important to us, Election Day and today with our king attending in person. Meanwhile, Richard has nothing to say about Bono attacking Pierre Poilievre or Trump's endorsement of Mark Carney because his outrage is selective. Things cost money. Canada shouldn't automatically be guaranteed to benefit from everything the Americans do. We shouldn't think that we are automatically entitled to permanently benefit from a American trade deficit with Canada, which is largely held up by tariffs that we apply to them. We charge them all kinds of tariffs. We've been over it on this channel before. There's two sets of tariffs. The reciprocal ones are just matching what we charge them to do business here in Canada because we charge them tariffs to protect our industries. And you can argue that that's necessary, but you also have to acknowledge that it's reality and it costs them money and all we do is insult the Americans. We have nothing but invective for them. Elbows up was just a hysterical response to taxes, which Canadians love. We're such an overtaxed, overburdened nation. We love applying tariffs to the world. We're one of the most heavily regulated markets on earth, or at least in the Western world. And we just got bent out of shape because we were told to. We were whipped into a frenzy. And now that frenzy has just gone away. And the liberal voter has just moved on. Robert says, why should anybody believe anything coming out of the White House? Home of lies. Canada has to leave NORAD, Golden Dome, LOL. I'm not really even sure what's going on there. A bankrupt country, a bankrupt and corrupt president. Morals, honesty, trust, LOL. Don't be foolish. It's the USA in 2025. And he leads with the Tesla stock ticker, with NVIDIA. It's just, maybe this is just a bot. But let's talk about Canada's finances. Canada had third largest increase in total government relative to the economy among 40 high-income countries. The deterioration of Canada's finances internationally in recent years, governments in Canada greatly expanded their role in the overall economy through more debt-financed spending. However, a larger government and rising debt burden imposed costs on Canadians in the economy. Guess what? Canadians in the real economy, the makers, the ones that are paying for all of the takers' projects, are going broke. The value of the Canadian dollar, its purchasing power, is in decline. Your national debt is going up without even parliamentary oversight through these special warrants we've detailed in this video and in other videos. This guy on Twitter talking about how we are, how the Americans are bankrupt. Yeah, the Americans have financial problems, but they have a much larger economy and a greater ability to recover with tens of trillions of dollars in investment pouring into the United States. That much is true because they're creating a favorable environment for capital deployment in the United States. That's why businesses are leaving Canada. That's why capital is leaving Canada. That's why many citizens are just leaving Canada, because it's becoming harder and harder to do business here and thrive here. It's tough times. Meanwhile, Carney says, Canada is looking to join major European military buildup. Well, what's a military buildup but more spending? And instead of aligning with the United States, our natural neighbor, he wants to align us with Europe and their goal of triggering a third world war with Russia. Germany has now deployed 4,800 troops to Lithuania. German troops have been permanently deployed for the first time since World War II. A brigade of 4,800 German soldiers is now positioned in Lithuania on NATO's eastern flank. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz is eager to wage war on Russia, stating, "The security of our Baltic allies is also our security. Ukraine's not a NATO member." There's a lot that went into the triggering of the Ukraine war. Russia's not the lone villain here. Peace was on the table multiple times, which the West torpedoed. And a lot of blood is on our hands. And as we talked about yesterday, the Europeans are at least saying that all restrictions have been lifted on long-range strikes into Russia. It's the West that is escalating. And this is going to tie into Trump's failure to get a peace agreement in Ukraine and actually stop the killing, because there's a lot of headwinds. This isn't blaming Trump. This isn't even questioning Trump's motives. It's going to be a reality check, which we'll get into shortly. But back to this. He wants to do this thing with Europe and increase government spending to pay for the military. Meanwhile, we can't keep personnel. Leaked Canadian military report shows many new recruits are quickly leaving. It's not just the lack of material. It's not just the poor housing on military bases. It's the DEI woke nonsense. It's the total lack of attention to military preparedness. Now, this article goes into some detail, avoiding talking about those very real things, but people don't really want to fight for Canada anymore. They don't want to join up to this woke military. So what comes next? There's been articles and whispers of conscription, because if we can't fill the shortfall, if we are indeed set on building a strong military to counter the United States, as if we can even do that? Why are we countering the United States when our prime minister identified during a debate that China is our greatest geopolitical adversary? If that's true, if Carney actually believes that China is our greatest geopolitical adversary, who is our natural geopolitical ally in countering China? Any guesses? Of course, the United States, our neighbor, our biggest trading partner. The best relationship between two countries, that the world has ever seen. I actually think that's a very realistic statement. Maybe we could have a debate on it, but it's at least in the top three or five of relationships of all time between nations on this planet. And we have a government that's actively torpedoing it and trying to align us with a bloc that's a world away committed to World War III. World War III, folks, kills us all. It ends civilization. You really should be against it. You should be peace advocates. But this is the state of Canada that this is what we live in under Mark Carney. And since I try to keep these to a half hour, I guess we'll have to do the maid segment tomorrow. But I want to talk about the headwinds in the United States. There's a lot of people in Canada who think we can just count on Trump riding in on a silver steed to save Canada and turn us into a 51st state quickly, and it's going to solve all our problems. Or that Alberta and Saskatchewan will inevitably become states themselves, and it'll be easy peasy. It's all part of the plan. Just sit back, eat your popcorn, enjoy the show. There's a lot of that attitude, which is a carryover from 2016. It's the same mottos that the Q movement deployed, that everything was under control, that it was all scripted, and all you had to do was sit back and watch. That's a terrible message, especially if people listen to it, because it means you're not doing anything. It means you're not thinking. It means you're a passive viewer of events. It's bad advice. You should always be taking an active role. Musk blasts Trump's spending bill for undermining Doge and claims DC treated them as whipping boys. Elon Musk's bromance with Donald Trump has taken a hit for the tech billionaire, blasted the White House for undermining him and treating Doge like whipping boys. The billionaire Tesla CEO spoke to the press before launching a SpaceX Starship into the stratosphere on Tuesday and unleashed on Trump's $3.8 trillion spending bill. It undermines the work that the Doge team is doing. I was disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decreases it. So Musk, whether you love him or hate him, has been working for free inside of the U.S. government, taking a lot of heat and hate from Canada because he's a visible public target. He's a big guy. But he isn't doing anything to Canada. I mean, if you're going to be irrationally angry at anybody, be angry with the Trump administration. I guess that's what you got to do. If you're not going to think rationally, at least focus your anger in the right place. But instead, we're doing stupid things like banning Teslas from the International Car Show. What is this doing? It's not actually doing anything to the Trump administration, which Musk is struggling with too. He is trying to advocate for fiscal restraint in the United States that creates a sustainable future for all Americans. And he's running into the same headwinds that Donald Trump is running into. Trump admin refuses to confirm whether it's lifted range restrictions on missiles to Ukraine. Trump is frustrated right now because he can't untie the Gordian knot that is the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and he is being opposed on all sides. Dr. Steve Turley says, sorry, but if you want to destroy your base and watch your presidency go down in flames, start something with Russia, because Trump has been emoting very aggressively towards the Russians, blaming them for irrational behavior and escalation. All of this is to say, I don't necessarily want to get into this too deep, but Trump is having some problems delivering on his promises made during the election campaign, similar to the headwinds he ran into in 2016, which derailed a lot of his presidency. Now, these are early days. Maybe he's got more control of the situation. I've highlighted before that this second administration, he has more power and more knowledge than he had in the first administration. If you believe his intent is good, then that's a point to celebrate. But the fact is, things are getting bogged down in a different way. He's got a judiciary that's fighting him actively, opposing his executive orders and delaying them. And that's going to continue. We are now in May. He was sworn in January. Very soon, he'll be 20% of the way through his administration, this first year of his term. Time is slipping by. That's the only thing I'm trying to do the math in my head of exactly what percentage of time's passed by. It doesn't really matter. Time is slipping by, and the agenda is getting bogged down and many things have disappeared off the radar. Where are those Epstein files? What's actually happening? The deep state's not going easy. And to the point of Canada, counting on the Trump administration to save us from our own problems is super foolish. Now, this is the CBC, because the attack is turning to the separatists. Separatists say Alberta's culture is rooted in traditional values. Many say those values don't define them. If you've ever lived in Ontario, as I have, and then you come and you live in the West, you'll identify right away how different things are here. This is a distinct society. Western Canada is its own thing. Particularly rural Western Canada is its own distinct society. It's agrarian. It's Christian. It has deeply rooted family values. These are things that are disappearing in the cities and across this country. Bloc, and they lead, they open this article by quoting Bloc Quebecois leader Blanchette, said earlier this month that if Alberta were to separate from Canada, it would first have to define itself as a nation with a distinct culture. I'm not certain that oil and gas qualifies to define a culture. Why are they quoting a separatist? And why is a separatist defining who can separate from this country? This is CBC at their most biased. Now remember, this country is run for the Laurentian elites. A lot of them live in Quebec and Ontario. So it's not really surprising for anybody that's paying attention. Further in the article, Alberta separatists are trying to make the case that Alberta, like Quebec, does have a culture that is distinct from the rest of Canada, one rooted in traditional conservative values. But recent polling and many people living in Alberta paint a more complicated picture. Talking about the cities, where all that mass immigration is landing. The population of both Alberta and Saskatchewan is growing from largely developing world sources that don't share our cultural values. We have the same problem that the rest of the nation is facing, and that is that in the cities, the culture that has actually built these places is being replaced and phased out. And so if you go and you ask those people questions about what defines, if you're asking people who just got here what defines the place that they live, they're going to have a very different answer from those who have lived here for multiple generations. What makes Quebec a distinct society? Language? The fact that they're willing to use the notwithstanding clause anywhere they want to impose their will upon the province with the rest of the country's establishment signing off on it? Quebec gets away with everything. But anytime the provinces raise their voices and try to claim the same rights, it is a wall-to-wall sea of articles like this, pushing back and pushing down that autonomy movement. Now, Trump's not coming to the rescue. But if we want to end the 150-year-long trend of the western part of this nation getting screwed over by the center, we're going to have to take it. We're going to have to claim it provincially. We're going to have to follow the Quebec model, even if guys like Blanchett are fighting us every step of the way, because they don't want to share the spotlight. Quebec wants Canada bent over for their advantage. They don't want other provinces starting to play the same game, because that will take the attention off them. That will take some of their power away. And to hell with them. We need to take their power away, because the federal government's backwards. The system is broken. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms is optional. Representation sucks. We're going broke doing things this way. And all Western Canada is doing is pouring its capital into a great big fire, a great big furnace that is Ottawa, where they burn all the money and prosperity and stand in our way of building things and actually creating a firm and lasting destiny for the people who live here. So it's time to tune out all the noise, and it's probably time to stop thinking the cavalry's going to come and Trump's got everything solved. This is a dangerous, toxic attitude. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of vocal opposition. I talked in yesterday's video about Carla Beck, who, I mean, it's almost like domestic policy here in Saskatchewan has completely disappeared. She's not even talking about the forest fires. There's people out there clamoring. What is Scott Moe going to do about the forest fires? Let me just show you what we're talking about here. Keep in mind that this is a province of a million people. This is the biggest wildfire going right now. It's gone on a hell of a run. It used to be two fires, and in the last couple of days, it's become one big, gigantic fire. No politician can solve this. It's in the middle of the bush. There isn't enough resources in the entire country to water bomb this thing out of existence. Somehow, people don't understand. If you choose to live in the bush or you choose to live near the bush, there's a risk. That's why you buy insurance. There's a risk because the forest is trying to renew itself. It's designed to burn. You can't stop it. It's inevitable. And when it's in isolated locations like this, these fires are just going to run their course. This isn't the responsibility of government. This is nature. This is natural. This isn't climate change. This is what forests have always done. Many of the trees that we look at and enjoy and we harvest require fire for their seeds to sprout. So there's nothing government can do about this, but it's interesting because Carla Beck in the past has been all about blaming forest fires on the Saskatchewan government as if they've never happened before. She's not even talking about it. Not that I've seen. Maybe I've missed something. Her main focus is on propping up Canada and saying that Canadian unity is the most important thing to her, not her constituents, not the prosperity of the province, not doing the right thing by Saskatchewan, not telling the truth about the abusive relationship between Ottawa and the West, but signaling her undying loyalty to the looters in Ottawa. And to me, that's a problem. It should be a problem to you. A real leader of the province, a person running in provincial politics, should be encouraging the citizens to voice their concerns as loudly as possible and in an organized way to strengthen their hand in negotiations with the federal government. That's what they should all be doing. But they're not. I don't even think Mo or Daniel Smith is leading as strong on these files as they could be, and maybe they will in the future. But I really question this undying loyalty to the system that is Canada. When they talk about how Canada is a country and how they're proud of it and how we have to keep it all together, what they're talking about is the system. They're talking about the Federation. They're not talking about the people or the land. They're talking about the Constitution. They're talking about the Charter. They're talking about, again, the system. And the system sucks.